Hello and welcome to the 20 Lessons You Need to Learn to Be an Informed Jew podcast. This week, we are just doing this as a podcast. We're not going to be having the in-person session. Now, the past three sessions, the past three installments have been pretty heady, have been quite philosophical. We've spoken about God and we've spoken about the system of Judaism and some evidence, the survey of evidence. Today I thought we would take a break from that, those types of discussions, and instead focus in on a mitzvah, on a specific commandment from the Torah, a specific idea in Judaism that is one of those that really is essential and foundational to who we are. And we'll go through it. We'll try to take a look at the way that Jewish, thousands of years of Jewish history and what the Torah has to tell us about this one specific mitzvah. And this mitzvah is tzedakah. Tzedakah, which we often will translate as charity. And tzedakah is so important to us. And I remember the first time I had to give a class on tzedakah, it made me recall that story with President Calvin Coolidge, President of the United States. He was a pretty quiet man, and one time he returned from a church service, and his wife asked him, "So what did the minister talk about?" Coolidge responded, "Sin." And what did he say? He was against it. And that was the end of the story. And sometimes I think when I was first asked to talk about tzedakah, I kind of thought the same thing. What exactly am I going to say about this? Unless we were going to make this into a very complicated class about the priorities in giving and the Jewish concept of giving a 1/10 of your earnings to tzedakah, which we are obligated to do, 1/10 of our earnings. In Hebrew, that's called maaser, ma'aser, which has the root word eser, a tenth, a tithe. Now, obviously, it's very complex how you give your 1/10. Is it, being after taxes? And what about if you're spending it on this? And what about if you're receiving investment income? All of those are wonderful questions and are many classes on their own. And that's not what we're going to talk about today. Today, we're going to talk about, besides for mentioning that we do have a Jewish obligation of giving 1/10 of our earnings to tzedakah, we're not really going to get into the complexities of giving 1/10 of our earnings. And if that's the case, it became, in my mind, it was, what exactly am I supposed to talk about when we talk about tzedakah? We all know how important giving money is to those that need it. What else is there to say? But the truth is, there's a lot to say. And the truth is that I think that Judaism has a very specific perspective when it comes to charity, when it comes to what we, when it comes to tzedakah, which we often translate as charity. Although we will see, I do not believe that that is the correct translation. So how does Judaism view tzedakah? So I think we should start with a verse early on in the Torah. We're looking for a moment at Bereshit, or Genesis, chapter 18, verse 19, where God is explaining why God chose Abraham to kind of become the father of this new faith. And what God says is as follows, "For I have known him, because he commands his sons," or so that he will command his sons, but really because he commands his son and his household after him, "that they should keep the way of the Lord, to perform righteousness and justice." Tzedakah umishpat, righteousness and justice would probably be the translation we're going to use right now. Or justice and justice, or doing what's right and justice. But what we do see is that God knew about Abraham, that he would direct his children, or that he would, that he did direct his children and his household to do acts of justice and righteousness. And one of those words is tzedakah. So we see very clearly that the reason God chose Avraham, God chose Abraham as the father of what would become this ethical monotheism, this new faith, this new religion, this new set of beliefs. The reason Abraham was chosen was because he engaged in tzedakah, and he made sure that that his children and his household did afterwards. God seemed to have read Abraham perfectly, and so it has been throughout history. The generous giving of tzedakah is one of the extraordinary attributes of the Jewish people. Worldwide, tzedakah is responsible for the critical support of those that are in need, as well as for maintaining the Jewish community's own infrastructure, our schools, our synagogues, our mikvaot, our ritual baths, our hospitals in general, orphanages, etc. A 2010 study at the University of Indiana revealed that individual Jewish philanthropy in the U.S. far exceeds that of any other group. There was a very big study done in the early 21st century. Basically, they looked at 865 philanthropic, or the 865 philanthropic gifts of $10 million or more made by American donors between 1995 and 2006, and they found in the United States, and they found that nearly 25% of these mega grants were made by Jews. So, tzedakah. Not only was God right about Abraham engaging in tzedakah, but that he would teach it to his children and his household after him, and that would become a hallmark of this new people. And that is exactly what has happened. It plays a foundational role, a fundamental role in the Jewish psyche, in the Jewish faith. There is a small story I want to share with you. There was a Hasidic Rebbe, a Hasidic spiritual master. And he would always say that everything in God's creation has a purpose. And one time, one of his more courageous disciples said, well, if that's the case, what's the purpose of apikorsis? What's the purpose of heresy? Why is it that people, what's the purpose of this way of thinking of denying that God exists? To which he answered, to which this rabbi answered, heresy is indeed purposeful. Because when you are confronted by another who is in need, you should imagine at that point, you should become a heretic, that there is no God to help, but that you alone can meet that person's needs. That's the purpose of heresy. But the truth is that is exactly how Judaism views tzedakah. And let's share this perspective by talking about a specific thought. So one aspect of charity, the Torah goes through many different aspects of giving and different modes of giving that we're obligated to engage in. One of those is called peah. A lot of them are agricultural, and one of those agricultural forms of giving is called peah. And the idea of peah, which means a corner, is that if you own land and comes harvesting time, then you have to leave over the last corner of your field for the poor. You're not allowed to harvest it for yourself. You have to leave it over so that those in need can harvest it for themselves. Now, we see very clearly that the sages in the Talmud, they stress that the area left over for those that are in need must be the very last edge harvested, the very last corner harvested. In other words, you can't set aside a section at the start or in the middle of the harvesting process. It has to be at the end. And the question is why? If the obligation is just to make sure that there's a leftover area for the poor on your field, why does it have to be the last part that you would harvest? Why can't it be the beginning or the middle? Why must it be the end? So the Talmud in Tractate Shabbos, in Maseches Shabbos, asks this question and answers that this provision prevents four potential problems. And what I want to tell you about right now is the first of these four potential problems. The Talmud says that this prevents stealing from the poor. And the basic idea is that the landowner could potentially set aside, if not for this law, the landowner could potentially set aside the peah, the corner, or this unharvested part of his field, at some prearranged hour, which would then, in order to make sure that the corner produce will go to friends or relatives instead of the needy. So if I would say, if I decide, okay, I'm going to leave over this one part of the field, and I'm going to make sure I harvest this one part of the field at 9 a.m., I could theoretically pick the needy that I wanted to go to. And I would pick, that's what would end up happening. So therefore, the Torah tells us, the sages tell us, no, you have to wait till the very end, because that way everybody has a fair chance at it. So that's a very interesting way of thinking. But what I want to point out is an insight from Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, Rabbi Cook, HaRav Cook, who was the first chief rabbi of Israel. It wasn't even Israel at that point. It was British-mandated Palestine at that point. But he was the first chief rabbi, a leader of the religious Zionist movement. But what he points out is as follows. He says, think about the language that the Talmud uses. Because if you don't leave over the last part of the field, then you will be stealing from the poor. Stealing from the poor. Now, what does that mean? You're stealing from the poor. This poor, this money, this field, this agriculture, this produce never belonged to the poor in the first place. So by keeping it, how could you say that I am stealing from the poor? Maybe you're not giving what we should be giving to the poor. But to say that you're stealing is, especially when we use these exact languages in the Hebrew language, stealing is taking something that somebody else has, not keeping something that is intended to go to this general, this vague, poor person. So how do we understand this? And based on this, Rav Kook explains something that he has many different proofs for, has a lot of evidence for throughout the Torah. But this is one of his sources, and it's a nice source. He explains that when in the Torah, that according to Judaism, when we talk about tzedakah, when we talk about charity, it's not simply a matter of generosity. It is not just a function of being kind. It is a social and moral obligation. It is a matter of being just. And in fact, the Hebrew word for charity, tzedakah, comes from the Hebrew, is from that word tzedek, which means justice. In other words, when I do not give what I am supposed to be giving, so whether it's the peah, the corner of my field, or a tenth of my earnings, I am not simply not being kind, but I am actually being unjust. The way we look at it is that we are not owners of what we have. God could have easily blessed others with an abundance of produce or an abundance of earnings and made us the ones that would need to be supported. God, however, entrusted us with the responsibility to make sure that all of God's children who are in need are taken care of. And therefore, in reality, when we do not give what we are supposed to be giving, what God mandates us to give, we are actually stealing money that was in trust through us for others, for those that are in need, because it's not just a matter of being kind, it's a matter of being just, and that really is what tzedakah means. So we should not be translating tzedakah as charity, because charity connotes this idea of I have money, I am kind, and I generously want to give it away. It actually means justice. I have a social and moral obligation to do exactly this. I one time heard a story. It was about a 93-year-old. His name was Menachem Koenig Sofer. And at 93 years old, he announced a startling new venture. And it went like this. He was celebrating his 93rd birthday together with his family. And he shared with his family at that point that he was going to be taking over an elderly relative whose health insurance had run out. And this relative was about to be prematurely discharged from a nursing facility. Menachem decided that he was going to take over all of her expenses. The relative's family was stunned. And when the relative's family was stunned when he shared that, but even more stunned was his own family when he shared it with them on his 93rd birthday. And they asked him, what exactly is going on here? Have you lost your mind? You are 93 years old, and did you all of a sudden come in to a great amount of money? What exactly is going on here? And he said, no. He said, no, not at all. I don't have one more cent than I did the day before. So they asked him, so how and why would you be willing to pay for this elderly woman's nursing home stay? You barely know. She's a relative, but she's not a close relative. And even if she was a close relative, how and why would you have been able to do this? And he smiled, and then he shared these words that I read and I think share this idea so poignantly. And he said as follows. He said, I always thought that as I got older, I would need to, I wouldn't want to burden my children. And in turn, I would go into an old age home. I would go into a home for the elderly, a nursing home. And what I did was, in order not to burden my children, is I slowly saved up over the past 40 years or over the past 50 years to make sure that I had in savings, that I had in savings, in an investment portfolio, enough to be able to support myself either with full-time help or in an old age home for many years, for 10, 15 years, you know, because I never wanted to burden my children. I am now 93 years old. It has become very clear to me that this money that I had set aside is definitely not going to be used, certainly not used, going to be used in full. I'm in great health, and so probably not being used at all. And as I was thinking about it, it hit me that obviously if I was saving this money for an old age home, if I was saving this money for full-time care, and now I no longer need it, then it is very clear that what I was really doing was saving it for somebody else. And when I heard about our elderly relative that was going to be discharged from this home because she could not afford it anymore, it became very clear that the person I was saving this for the past 40 and 50 years, was this woman, was this elderly relative of ours. And that is how I'm doing it, and that is why I am doing this. And for the next 4 years, Menachem took the money that he had saved for himself and supported this woman and saved the family from financial ruin. Interestingly enough, after 4 years, the woman was finally granted government funding to cover her hair, and 2 days later, to cover her care, and 2 days later, Menachem's soul ascended to heaven. So that was the story, but I think that that story is the true Jewish way of looking at tzedakah. We have this money, and some of it is meant, and the Torah gives us guidelines for how much of it, but some of it is meant not for ourselves, not to be kind, but to justly, it is given to us in trust to make sure that we can support God's children. Let's talk more about this idea. There's one question that I believe is important to ask because it says so much about the mitzvah of tzedakah. And the question is as follows. When we engage in mitzvot, when we fulfill these mitzvot, loosely translated as commandments, we always make a blessing before we do a mitzvah. So when we light the menorah, we say a blessing beforehand. Thank you, God, for giving us this mitzvah. When we eat the matzah at the Passover Seder, we make a blessing beforehand. When we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, we make a blessing beforehand. So if giving tzedakah is in fact a mitzvah, which it is, then why do we not say a blessing before we give tzedakah? And there are some technical answers to this question, and some of them are a bit more uplifting. So according to what we just said, I think we have our first answer. The idea is that when we talk about giving a blessing before doing a mitzvah, when we talk about saying a blessing before doing a mitzvah, we only say a blessing before we engage in a positive mitzvah, not before we abstain from a negative commandment. When we abstain from a negative commandment, there's no blessing that comes first. So according to what we were just saying, when we talk about tzedakah, certainly there is a positive commandment to give tzedakah, to give to those that are in need. But according to what we're saying, it also seems that when we do give tzedakah, in essence, we are abstaining from the negative commandment of not to steal, of not to take money that is not our own. So there certainly is a facet of a negative commandment that is incorporated when every time we give, every time we engage in the mitzvah of tzedakah. And perhaps it's because we can also look at tzedakah as a negative commandment, that's why we don't say a blessing beforehand, because we do not say a blessing when we are abstaining from a negative commandment. Why? That's a discussion for another time, but that could be a simple answer that takes into account what we have said up until this point. But I think there's a lot more, and I think some of these answers are very, very interesting and quite illuminating. The next answer I want to share is about not embarrassing, making the exchange as quickly as possible. And if we were to say a blessing, that would just make the exchange longer. And we want to go to the greatest extent possible. We go to the greatest lengths possible to make sure that the tzedakah exchange, when we are giving to somebody else who is in need, is as brief as possible, in order to maintain, to the best of our ability, the dignity of the person receiving, but also to make sure that the person receiving will actually take it. Now, obviously, there are going to be a lot of details where the process and where the interaction should be very long and should be full of kind words and a good disposition. But oftentimes, especially in certain scenarios, we want it to be as quick as possible in order to maintain the dignity of the person receiving. In fact, we are told of the Talmudic sage, Rabbi Chana bar Chanilai, that he never took his hand out of his pocket because he was worried that by the time he would put his hand in his pocket and take it out, the person in need would become too embarrassed to actually take the money. Right? So in those types of scenarios, it would make a lot of sense, and perhaps that's why we don't say a blessing, just in order to make sure that literally this exchange is as quick as possible. And as I said, there are many exceptions to that idea. Perhaps we can say it's because it would be insulting, because what we're saying is thank you, God, for giving us this opportunity to give tzedakah, and we'd be saying it as we are giving tzedakah to the person that is in need, which can be insulting and hurtful, thanking God for having put this person in this position where he needs to take your money so that you can fulfill the mitzvah of tzedakah. Right? There could be something insulting, something hurtful about that. The next answer that I want to share is about from a great commentary on the Talmud, the Rashba. And he explains that in order to make a blessing on a mitzvah, it has to be 100% entirely in our hands. And when we give tzedakah, that may not be the case. So, for example, when we make a blessing on the food needs to be in our hand, or at least in front of us, because who knows if it will actually be there. So let's give the example from when I was young. Back when I was in elementary school, we used to have we had water fountains. And every once in a while, the water fountain would stop working. And that would mean you would say the bracha, you would say the blessing that you would normally say before you drink water. And we'll talk about blessings in a different discussion. You would say the blessing you would say before you drink water, then you would turn on the water fountain and no water would come out, which would mean that the blessing that you said was actually in vain because there was no water. So what we were told to do is turn on the water fountain first, and when you see it's working, then you say the blessing and then you drink the water so that your blessing is not in vain. Because to make a blessing on the sustenance that you're getting and then not get it is a blessing in vain. So perhaps we can say the same thing when it comes to tzedakah. We have full intention to give this money. However, who says that the person that's going to be on the receiving end will actually take it? Maybe he's insulted by the way you're giving it. Maybe he's insulted by the way he thinks you're giving it. Maybe he doesn't like the amount you're giving. And for any one of those reasons, perhaps the exchange will not actually end up happening, and you would end up having a blessing in vain. That's another interesting answer. But I think the more interesting way of saying this answer is the opposite way, is perhaps you may not actually end up giving it. And for this, I want to turn your attention to the Shema prayer/declaration. One of the most important prayers or declarations in Judaism is the Shema. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And then the following paragraphs. It's a declaration that we say at least three times a day, if not more, in the morning, in the evening, and before going to sleep. And part of that first paragraph of Shema tells us, if you have to, you shall love the Lord your God, b'chol levavcha, with all of your heart, b'chol nafshecha, with your entire life, u'b'chol mi'odecha, and with all of your effort. That's maybe the best way to translate it. But the question is what is each one of these referring to? So the Talmud tells us, b'chol nafshecha means, when it comes to your, with all of your soul, with all of your being, that means that you even have to give your life for God. Obviously, that discussion is not for now as well, but there are instances where you need to give your life for God. And then you have the words, v'chol me'odecha, which means all of your money, right? That you even have to be willing to give all of your money for God. Again, that discussion is not for now, but that's the basic concept. There are instances where you have to give all of your money for God. So all of your life, your entire life, you have to be willing to give up your life for God. that's the type of love you should have for God, and you need to be willing to give up all your money for God. That's the type of love you have to have for God, just like you would for your family. Now, the question that is asked, is, wait a minute. Once we say you have to love God to the extent that you're willing to give up your life for God, then it would seem redundant to say that you have to love God so much that you would be willing to give up all your money for God. Obviously, your life is going to be more significant to you than all of your money. To which the answer is given that astonishingly there are plenty of people who love their money more than their lives. And we see this. We see people willing to ruin their entire lives for more money. And that is actually the case. So we see that money plays a very powerful role in the lives of many people. Parting with one's money is one of the most difficult things to do. And perhaps, and we suggest that perhaps if we require a bracha, if we require a blessing before we give tzedakah, before we give charity, that would give you some moments to change your mind. And knowing how difficult it is to part with one's money, that is an eventuality that we actually take into consideration. And therefore we say, do not say a blessing before you give tzedakah. Don't say a blessing before you give charity. Which then means that the struggle over the proper use of one's money is actually an opportunity to use our free will to make correct ethical, moral, and moral decisions and enhance our spirituality. So those are some of the ideas. Now, before we go further, let's just quickly sum up the major concept here, and that is as follows, that when you you have money, you are obligated to give a tithe. The Torah tells us this, you know, gives us guidelines as to what we must give. And now, according to what we're saying now, when we do not give, it's literally as if we are stealing from charity, because that money was in trust for those that are in need. That money is not our own. That's the basic idea. That's the revolutionary idea of tzedakah according to the Torah, according to Judaism. Now, I think there are a couple of things that come out from this incredible idea. Number one, this is an intense concept that we have money in trust, that God gave us in trust for those that are in need. It's about the most thrilling and empowering concept that we could possibly think of, because God could have given anyone extra money. By choosing you, God is saying, I want you to be my partner. God is singling out you to be God's partner in providing for God's children. And that's one of the most exciting and empowering things we can imagine. We were chosen by God to partner with him. We are God's hand-picked messenger to the world. The second thing we have to keep in mind is with great power comes great responsibility. Now that we are God's hand-picked partner, God's hand-picked messenger, we need to understand that we better do an amazing job at this test. We are entrusted with using God's money to provide for the world. We better do an amazing job at this task. This means putting in real thought and real effort into making sure we are fulfilling our task in the most effective way possible. Giving cannot just be somebody asks us for money and we give. Giving has to be a thought out, thoughtful endeavor, because we are partnering with God on this mission. I want to just share one quick story about thoughtfulness when it comes to tzedakah, about giving not just being the spontaneous being asked that I'm going to give a dollar here and I'm going to give a dollar here, but rather a certain thoughtfulness. It's a story that I think is really, really nice. It's a story about the Beis Halevi. The Beis Halevi, sometimes when we talk about great sages or great rabbis, we refer to them by the names, by the name of their greatest work, one of the books that they wrote, one of the Sfarim, one of the Jewish books that they wrote. So Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, who was the rabbi of Brisk in Lithuania, he wrote a book that he entitled Beis Halevi, and therefore we often refer to him as the Beis Halevi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. And he was sitting at his in this study hall, and someone came up to him and asked him a very unusual halachic question. We know that on Pesach, on Passover, we have our Seder, and at the Seder, we drink 4 cups of wine or grape juice. And this time, this man came up to him and said, Rabbi, is it permissible for me to drink 4 cups of milk at the Seder instead of 4 cups of wine at the Seder? The rabbi asked him, why do you want to do that? And he said, he first said, is wine bad for your health? Are you not able to drink grape juice? And he said, no, it's just that wine is too expensive for me. At that moment, the rabbi went into his desk and took out 20 rubles, which is quite a large sum of money. It was much more money necessary, it was much more than necessary to buy just wine. After the man left, someone present had seen that exchange, and he summed up the courage to ask the rabbi what exactly was going on. 3 or 4 rubles would have been sufficient to buy the necessary wine. Why did he give him 20? To which Rabbi Soloveitchik answered with a smile, and he said, think carefully, think carefully. This man is coming to ask me, can I use milk for my 4 cups at the Seder? Obviously, if he is using milk, if he is even thinking of using milk for the 4 cups of wine at the Seder, do you think he has enough to provide for his family's needs? Do you think he has enough money to provide for protein, for chicken, for meat at the Seder? Do you think he has enough to buy matzah for the Seder? Do you think he has enough to provide for his family's needs for the festival? Of course not. And that's why I gave him 20 rubles, because I need to provide for him for the entire Passover. So that's the basic idea. But there's a certain thoughtfulness there of understanding that if this is what's going on here, then this means this and this means this. And it's this type of understanding, this type of thoughtfulness that we need to bring to the table when it comes to our own charitable giving. So that's an important thing to remember. And this is exacerbated. This becomes even more significant when we think about the incredible opportunity that we are given. We are God's partners in this world. We are God's messengers to this world. Anyone that has money to give, anyone that has a tithe to give, we are God's messengers to this world to make sure that those that are in need, God's children that are in need, are provided for. God gave us that money and trust, entrusting us. To go ahead and do what is right. Okay, before we finish off, I just want to talk about two different lists of levels of charity that are very, some of them are actually quite well known, and I just want to make sure that we share them before we finish off. So, first, I want to turn your attention to the Rambam, to Maimonides' 8 levels of giving. This is in his work on Jewish law, Mishneh Torah, the laws of tzedakah, actually, Matnos Aniyim, the laws of the gifts to the poor, chapter 10. And we'll talk about the 8 levels of giving. The highest level of charity, according to the Rambam, is supporting someone who would otherwise have to beg. In modern terms, this is about breaking the poverty cycle. What is this a reference to? Giving somebody work, loaning someone some money, asking someone who is in need to become a partner in your business. It's breaking the cycle of poverty. It's not just giving them for them to provide for their needs, but it's actually taking someone and putting them in circumstances where they can improve their situation. So a loan, a job, a partnership, that would be the first level of tzedakah. It's interesting. You sometimes find these micro grant charities where you give small grants to people oftentimes in countries where many people are in need. You give small grants, small loans, I mean, micro loan charities, small loans to people who to help them kind of start a business, you know, a small business in a developing country. And oftentimes you'll see that in the marketing for these micro loan charities, you'll oftentimes find that the Maimonides is quoted here, that this is the greatest level of charity. The next level of charity is anonymous giving and receiving, where the person giving doesn't know who the person receiving is, and the person receiving doesn't know who's giving it. In the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, there used to be a courtyard where the righteous used to place their donations secretly, and the poor would be able to come and benefit from them in secret. Now, we're going to talk more about this soon. The third level of charity is where the giver knows who he or she is giving to, but the recipient does not know who it was that gave it. The fourth level of charity is when the recipient knows who the donor is, but vice versa is not the case. So the giver does not know who the recipient is. You have the stories in the Talmud of the Gedolei Chachamim, the great sages, who were known to walk, and as they would walk, they would place money behind their backs or parcels of food behind their back, and poor, those that were in need would come and walk behind them and take that. And that way, the person giving would not, at least not know who the person receiving was. Number five is to be proactive in your giving. To give before the person in need asks you for it. Number six is to give to somebody after you were asked. Number seven is to give to someone in a pleasant manner, but less than what they are asking for. And number eight is giving begrudgingly. And there's different, obviously, levels of this, but giving begrudgingly is the eighth level of charity. It's the lowest level of charity. And oftentimes, giving begrudgingly completely defeats the purpose. Now, we did talk about giving anonymously. There's certainly that is a value in Judaism, but the Ramah, and in fact the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, codifies this concept that you should never take pride in the tzedakah that you are giving. It should not become a source of pride for you, and that goes very well with what we're talking about, that God is merely entrusting you instead of somebody else. It's empowering and it's exciting, but it should never be a source of pride. And that's why you shouldn't publicize it. However, the Rashba, that commentary in the Talmud that we mentioned before, points out that there are exceptions to this rule. And the major exception to this rule is you're allowed to publicize it if it will encourage others. And that is oftentimes the case, and that's why you definitely see charity being publicized. People that are very humble that are giving, they allow their name to be publicized in order to encourage others to give as well. And that is totally legitimate, and not just legitimate, but appropriate to do. Okay, let's also talk about another very interesting list, another very important list. Again, we have, the Torah tells us about giving one-tenth of one's earnings to tzedakah. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says that it's a mitzvah min ha-mufchar, that it's a magnificent mitzvah to give one-fifth, but you definitely shouldn't give more than one-fifth, because giving charity should not, that's too excessive. That's not appropriate anymore. But the question is who do we give to first? What is the priority list? Now, the priority list I'm going to share is all about giving to those that are in need, like to individuals that are in need, to the needy, to the poor. But of course, there is also mitzvot to give to institutions, whether they be synagogues or whether they be Jewish schools or whether they be hospitals or whether they be mikvaot. There are certainly mitzvot to give those to those as well, but we're not going to talk about that today. We're just going to focus. Our last list is a focus on those that are in need. Who gets first? Who should you be giving first when you are divvying up your charity money for those that are in need? So the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, again, Rabbi Moshe Isserles was the chief rabbi of Krakow hundreds of years ago. And his work on the Code of Jewish Law has become a very important source for Jewish law that we practice till this day. So the Rama enumerates the list of priorities. Number one, parents. If your parents are in need, you should not be giving charity to anybody else until your parents are properly provided for. Number two is your children. You should not be giving to anyone else until your children are properly provided for. Next comes other relatives, and included in other relatives, which is very important to remember, included in other relatives is an ex-spouse. If an ex-spouse is not provided for, you have no permission to give to others, that are in need before relatives, including an ex-wife or husband, are provided for. Number four is neighbors. They would come next. You start from your very small circle, and then you allow that circle to get bigger and bigger and bigger when it comes to our tzedakah priorities. Next is the people of the town, the people that live in your city. So your city should be the next recipient. And then once they're taken care of, then the next priority should be Jerusalem and the land and those that are in the land of Israel, that are in Israel. And that's the next very important, very important list for us to keep in mind. I think that that is where we'll stop today. So going through tzedakah, the revolutionary concept of tzedakah, that it's not just about generosity, but it's actual justice. Rabbi Cook, who told us that it's actually stealing from the poor when we do not give according to the guidelines of the Torah. How we give, the thoughtfulness of giving, the difficulty of giving, and overcoming that, the priorities, the Maimonides, eight levels of giving, and the Ramah's priorities in giving are all things to keep in mind when we think about this foundational mitzvah, this fundamental mitzvah, the mitzvah of tzedakah, the mitzvah of charity, the first mitzvah that we have discussed here at our 20 Lessons podcast. Have a great day.